This is the podcast ICU Rounds. My name is Dr. Jeffrey Guy. I'm an associate professor of surgery and director of the Burn Center at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine in Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome back to the podcast. The topic that we're going to talk about today is something that we have had a rash of in the past several months, and that's caustic ingestions, people drinking things that are just absolutely out of this world. Typically, we see a lot of more of the alkali lye type ingestions, but we've had people drink things like battery acid and hydrofluoric acid. And the spectrum of patients who present with this problem have ranged from people who have rather profound toxidromes and have progressed rapidly to death, people who have done just fine, and people who have required rather significant operations. It's not something we see commonly, but being in a burn center, we do see it with some regularity, perhaps more regularity than a general intensive care unit. But it's still something interesting, and it's something I think that when patients present, that people have to kind of take pause and think, well, what is the right way to approach this patient, how to take care of them? So let's talk a little bit about an update on the management of caustic exposures. According to the American Association of Poison Control Centers Toxic Exposure Surveillance System, in the year 2004, there were roughly 200,000 exposures to various caustic substances. And this is both in household and industrial type settings, include things such as hydrochloric acid, potassium hydroxide, sodium hydroxide, sulfuric acid, phosphoric acid, as well as many others. Although the most commonly affected areas of the body are things such as the face, the eyes, and the extremities, all reported fatalities really were a result of ingestion. Little controversy exists in patient management following dermal or occlusive exposure, but there is a significant amount of controversy regarding how we approach patients with caustic ingestion. For patients who have had skin involvement with a caustic agent, the treatment is pretty straightforward, and that's immediate irrigation with water at the site of exposure. And frequently that magnitude of irrigation is much more than people would typically realize. I would say that a common error that occurs is that somebody will present to, say, an emergency department, and somebody will begin to irrigate the patient, and say if they had a burn on the center of their chest, irrigate them with 1 or 2 liters of fluid, and typically the irrigation stops once the irrigant fluid begins to run on the floor, because now you're making a mess. And we know how messes are just not a very popular thing in hospitals or hospital emergency departments. Well, the problem with that kind of methodology is that if you take the burn in the center of the chest, and it's a very strong acid, and you only had 1 or 2 liters of fluid, you're not really doing anything significant regarding dilution of the acid. And all you've really done is made the area of caustic exposure larger. And basically now you're marinating the patient in the acid or the base. It amazes me that a lot of times, particularly with alkali burns, that we may have to irrigate somebody for hours in a burn unit in order to get their pH down. We think about caustic agents, you know, there's the acids and the alkalis. I think people have the impression that acid burns are worse than alkali burns. And I don't know that I would share that impression. They burn differently, and the biology of all burns is created is not equal. When we think of a thermal burn, the biology of a thermal burn is different than the biology of something like a chemical burn. I like to tell people, if you imagine somebody who has breast cancer, we know you don't need to be a surgical oncologist to recognize that there are different types of breast cancers, and the biology of some breast cancers is more malignant and biologically aggressive than other types. Well, the same is true with burns, and I think chemical burns, at least in my opinion, are certainly more difficult to take care of than somebody who has a flame burn. And Dave Mazingo wrote a paper years ago that actually showed that the morbidity and mortality associated with a chemical burn is greater than a thermal burn. Acids and alkalis are different. They're not only different in the chemistry, acids having low pHs and alkali having strong pHs, but they're different in how they damage tissue. Acids create something called a acids cause something called a coagulative necrosis. And a coagulative, basically, as the tissue denatures, it forms a physical barrier that does not allow the acid to continue to penetrate deeper into the tissue. That seems to almost have somewhat of a protective type a function, because the acid sits on the tissue, it denatures it, and creates a physical barrier, and then the acid cannot continue to go into the tissue. The alkali creates something called liquefaction necrosis. And liquefaction is what it sounds like. It liquefies the tissue. So as it liquefies the tissue, it basically dissolves it and allows the alkali exposed the ability to be exposed to the deeper tissue. And therefore, it can damage the deeper tissue, liquefies it, gets exposed to the next layer of tissue or the next layer of cells. And so alkali burns are able to create really profound tissue destruction. There's a lot of alkali in the environment. Lye, I think, is the one that people typically, their minds will wonder too. We see a lot of chemical burns, alkali, particularly in the manufacturing of methamphetamine. One of the component materials is a strong base. There's a surgical axiom that the solution for pollution is dilution, and irrigation is the key thing that we need to do here. You want to avoid some of these recommendations that you may get in regards to using neutralizing agents. A lot of, particularly if you're in an occupational environment, if you're using Agent A, and say Agent A is an acid, and somebody says, well, in order to neutralize the acid, you need to provide compound X. A lot of those neutralization type recommendations have been really tested more on industrial equipment and not on actually on patients. The other risk of doing that is a lot of these reactions create exothermic reactions. And so those of you who may not know what an exothermic reaction is, it's a very basic chemical principle that when you neutralize, say, an acid with a base, it creates a chemical reaction that does neutralize the acid, but it also gives up heat. And in doing so, you could actually create a thermal injury to the exposed portion of the body. So not something that you want to be doing. Well, let's talk about somebody who drinks acid or base. Obviously, we're concerned about the likelihood of internal injury with the ingestion of an acid or base. And the likelihood and severity of esophageal injury after caustic ingestion is related to several factors. That includes the pH. Also, the physical state of the ingested acid or alkali. Is it a solid, liquid, or gel? As well as the tissue contact time, as obviously the quantity and concentration of the substance ingested. And all this really seems to make a lot of sense. If you imagine that when we talk about whether a particular exposure to a flame causes a partial or full thickness burn or a particular hot liquid, things we're looking for are the temperature and the duration of exposure. And certainly in this situation, well, what is the quantity of the material? Did they ingest, 10 milliliters or 100 milliliters? Was it a material of pH 2 or a material of pH 4? Was it a solid or was it a gel or a liquid? Because you can certainly think of the physical properties of something like a gel, which runs very slowly down an esophagus, where something that's very liquid may run very briskly down the esophagus. Again, thinking like something like a scald burn. Somebody gets burned by hot water, the water runs off the extremity pretty quickly. But if you have hot, viscous grease, it kind of, is gooey and gelatinous and kind of has a longer contact time and therefore a longer burn. Now, the pH can be determined in an emergency department by something as simple as litmus paper testing if the product is available. And the key thing there is if it's available. One of the absolute obscene, ridiculous things that have happened with American medicine with the introduction of government intervention is something with point-of-care testing. Litmus paper was something that I learned to use, I think, in 8th grade science. Does a piece of paper turn a particular color? Well, under now all this wonderful, helpful government regulation in healthcare, litmus paper is now considered point-of-care testing. And in a lot of hospitals, and ours included, litmus paper has been quickly rushed off to the lavatory to be used by the skilled hands of very trained technicians. And in order for our nursing staff and our burn unit to actually use litmus paper, we had to do an in-service on litmus paper, do an assessment of their ability to understand the use of litmus paper, and then had to do a skills testing on how to use litmus paper. Now, we said the tissue contact time may be influenced by the actual physical state of the agent, because ingested solids are more likely to adhere to, say, mucous membranes or the GI tract, and therefore they have that prolonged contact time. Now, when you look at animal models, particularly in a rat model, caustic soda, which is sodium hydroxide, this has been shown to cause esophageal damage after 10 minutes of contact time, and it'll cause a esophageal perforation after 120 minutes of contact time. Now, further, in this particular animal study, the solution concentration was determined to be the most important predictor of esophageal damage. Caustic soda concentrations of 1.83% were sufficient to cause epithelial necrosis, whereas concentrations of 7.33% induced submucosal damage, and concentrations of 14.33% resulted in muscle and adventitial damage. And the data for this reference is by Madison colleagues in the Laryngoscope, year 2006, volume 116, pages 456 to pages 460. When you get typically this kind of granularity of data, this kind of specific information, it's not going to be something with an ingestion. Most of the ingestions are not accidental. They're usually intentional in the patient trying to commit suicide. And therefore, they make some of these really bizarre cocktails, or they'll take some sort of household agent. And usually the material is not brought to the emergency department, or you don't get a nice material safety data sheet like you would in an occupational exposure where somebody has an acid spilled on them in a work-type setting. So don't hold your breath that you're going to be getting this kind of, you know, somebody ingested soda and tells you that it's a 7.83% soda. It's statistically a very low probability occurrence that you're going to get that information. We mentioned that the acids and alkali actually damage tissue differently. Acids cause coagulative necrosis with eschar formation that limits substance penetration and injury depth. Alkalis, in contrast, combine with tissue proteins, and they cause liquefaction necrosis and a saponification, and are classically taught to penetrate deeper in the tissues. Now, additionally, alkali absorption leads to thrombosis in blood vessels and impeding blood flow into already damaged tissue. And as you're impeding blood flow in the damaged tissue, it's like a burn patient that gets poorly resuscitated, that this tissue that is vulnerable will then, you know, in a poorly resuscitated circumstance, will then go on to die. Now, these mechanisms of injury suggest that alkali ingestion would lead to more serious injury and complications. However, the distinction between acid and alkali burns is probably not clinically relevant in the setting of strong acid, strong base, because both are able to penetrate the esophageal tissues pretty rapidly, and both are potentially able to lead to full thickness damage of the esophageal wall. There's a study by Poli and colleagues in Gastrointestinal Endoscopy, 2004, volume 60, pages 372 to 377. And in that particular study, strong acid ingestion was actually associated with longer hospital stays, increased incidence of systemic complications such as renal failure, liver dysfunction, and disseminated intravascular coagulation and hemolysis when compared with alkali ingestion. We've recently had a patient who really went down all of that course and basically died a rather rapid death from really that toxidrome of a strong acid. So let's go over those things that you see, complications, renal failure, liver dysfunction, and in our case, liver failure, DIC, as well as hemolysis. And hemolysis, I think these patients typically land on surgical services, and I don't think that hemolysis is something that surgeons typically really have in the forefront of their mind when we think see a low hemoglobin, we think someone is bleeding, because the majority of patients that we care for who will have a rapid decline in their hemoglobin typically is related to blood loss. I think those of us who care for burn patients with some regularity are looking for hemolysis probably more commonly, because blood is a thermally labile tissue. And so if you have somebody who is a victim of a rather significant structure fire, that you can see hemolysis related just to the burn exposure. And here's another circumstance where a ingestion of acid will lead your patients to potentially have hemolysis. And so you need to be mindful of that and certainly looking for that. There has been some interesting research that may indicate that the damage to the esophageal tissue is perhaps a little bit more complicated than we think, particularly when we compare it to damage related to skin, and that there may be some oxygen free radical metabolism that may kind of amplify the tissue injury in a fashion that's unique to the esophagus when comparing it to skin. Now, esophageal injury may begin within minutes after ingestion of a corrosive agent, and it may persist for hours after the ingestion. histologically, what goes on initially is that tissue injury is really marked by eosinophilic necrosis and swelling and eventually hemorrhagic congestion. About 4 to 7 days after ingestion, you'll begin to see mucosal sloughing and bacterial evasion can occur. This period, about 4 to 7 days, is also characterized by inflammation and the appearance of granulation tissue. It's also during this time that ulcers can be covered with can become covered with a fibrinous type layer. Now, perforation can occur at any time if ulceration exceeds the muscular plane. Fibroblasts also appear at injury sites around day 4. On day 5, roughly, you get this esophageal mold is formed, and this esophageal mold really consists of dead cells, secretions, and possibly food. On around day 10 after ingestion, esophageal repair really begins to initiate. And finally, at about 1 month after the ingestion, esophageal ulcerations begin to re-epithelialize. And these histological characteristics of the esophagus following causal congestion. Well, clinically, how do we go about evaluating these patients, and what are some of the studies that we might do? Patients who initially will present for medical care following ingestion of a caustic agent, they can have a variety of signs and symptoms. Many patients will be asymptomatic. Others can be complaining of nausea, vomiting, dysphagia, odontophagia. Those of you who, there's a lot of people listening to this who are just getting in the medicine, and odontophagia is painful swelling. Drooling is always a bad sign. Abdominal pain and chest pain are very bad signs, and stridor is a real red flag that action needs to be taken rather promptly. There have been some attempts made to kind of correlate the patient's symptoms and physical findings with esophageal injury, but the literature on this topic really has not been any kind of slam dunks. It's been inconclusive. There was a study that found the presence of two or more signs or symptoms, including vomiting, drooling, or stridor, predicted esophageal injury. The reference for that... Crane and colleagues in American Journal of Disease and Children, 1984, Volume 138, pages 863 to 865. There was a more recent study that suggested that drooling and dysphagia alone correlated with esophageal injury, and a study after that that found that patients who had more than three signs or symptoms following a corrosive ingestion had increased likelihood of esophageal injury. There is something that, you know, oftentimes we focus on the positive findings, but also there's some negative findings that are important to consider, and it has been demonstrated that the absence of oropharyngeal injury does not exclude an esophageal or gastric lesion. In one series, there was 12% incidence of a grade 2 esophageal lesion in asymptomatic patients. That's from Gondralt and colleagues, Journal of Pediatrics, 1983, Volume 71, pages 767 to 770. Rigo and colleagues in Endoscopy, 2002, reported that white blood cell count greater than 20,000, as well as age, strong acid ingestion, and the presence of deep esophageal ulcers or necrosis, the predictors of mortality. Let me go through that again, because one of the patients that we just recently had several of these, and that's white count greater than 20,000, age, strong acid, presence of deep esophageal ulcers or necrosis, and those are predictors of mortality. Now, despite these findings, hemolysis as well as DIC, renal failure, and liver failure have all been reported following caustic ingestion. And this suggests really that laboratory studies may be useful in guiding some patient management, but not necessarily predictive of morbidity and mortality. But, you know, we had a patient who had a presumptive ingestion of battery acid and hydrofluoric acid as well as carbon tetrachloride. And that patient, obviously, the laboratory data was very helpful in helping us manage that patient because the patient really went into a rather rapid progression of both renal failure and liver failure. Now, adult patients who have signs and symptoms of a perforated viscus, peritonitis, mediastinitis, or hemodynamic instability may require prompt surgical evaluation and intervention. We recently had a patient who we did an endoscopy. The esophagus was really looking very poor. It was rather ecchymotic, and not just ecchymotic, it was gray and black, and there were ulcerations throughout the stomach as well as the distal esophagus. We did a CAT scan, consulting with one of our surgical endoscopists, because we were really kind of concerned about what did the tissue around the esophagus look like, and we found free air. So that was, you know, time to go. You know, don't need much more as far as surgical evaluation is required there. But patients, you know, you may need exploratory laparotomy or laparoscopy. resection of necrotic tissue, esophagectomy, and consideration for delayed clonic interposition in people who have some, you know, those clinical signs and symptoms. Now, patients presenting with abdominal pain, peritoneal finds, should have a chest and abdominal radiographs to determine the presence of intraperitoneal air or mediastinal air. Be mindful that, you know, those studies may not be very sensitive for free air. A CAT scan may be more sensitive, but if they're positive, you have your ticket to cut. Now, criteria for emergent surgery have been proposed, and these include the presence of shock or DIC, the need for hemodialysis, acidosis, and degree of esophageal injury as seen on endoscopy. And the reference for that is Bruin and colleagues, the British Journal of Surgery, 1984, volume 71, pages 698 to pages 700. Crucial in the initial evaluation of patients who have had ingested corrosives is the performance of an esophagogastroduodenoscopy, or EGD. Now, initial endoscopies when approaching this problem were rigid in nature, and endoscopy then was associated with an increased incidence of esophageal perforation. So this is something that, you know, when we talk about doing endoscopy in these patients, we're all very much concerned. Nobody wants to harm a patient, and whenever you're doing endoscopy for any reason, you know, esophageal perforation is a real concern and consideration. But to not proceed with endoscopy over fears paralyzing your activity of perforation, you have to be mindful that, you know, a lot of those high incidence reports were done with rigid, not flexible, esophagoscopy. Now, with flexible EGD, it's been established as a safe and reliable tool for assessing esophageal damage up to 96 hours after caustic ingestion, as long as, you know, the endoscopist is using gentle insufflation during the procedure. Only clinical or radiological suspicion for perforated viscus is a contraindication for EGD. The reference for that is Zagar and colleagues, Gastrointestinal Endoscopy, 1991, volume 37, number 2, page 165 to 169. Virtually any injury nowadays has a grading scale to it, and nothing is unique about esophageal injuries. The grades go from 0, 1, 2A, 2B, 3A, and 3B. And but I think this one is rather easy to commit to memory than the different injuries, scaling for pancreas or liver trauma. Grade 0 is a normal esophagus. Grade 1, mucosal edema and hyperemia. The corollary to that would be a first-degree burn, and it's descriptive of a first-degree burn. Mucosal edema and hyperemia, you can see where that is comparative to a first-degree burn. 2A and 2B. 2A is friability, hemorrhages, erosions, blisters, whitish membranes, exudate, and superficial ulcerations. 2B is deep or circumferential ulcerations, in addition to 2A lesions. So 2A looks a lot like a second-degree burn. When it's 2B is when it's circumferential. 3A and 3B. 3A is small or scattered areas of necrosis, and 3B is extensive necrosis. We recently had a gentleman who drank a bunch of lye, and he had basically the distal third of his esophagus, particularly posteriorly, was black and gray. And so, and additionally, there was elements of 2B all around that. So again, that's a pretty extensive esophageal injury. And that grading scale is from Gastro Intestinal Endoscopy, 1991. The authors on that are Zagar and colleagues. What's the relevance of having such a grading scale? Well, you can go back and characterize some of the injuries. It makes us be able to communicate. A surgeon from Vanderbilt can communicate with a surgeon from Duke or from UCLA or for Harborview, for instance, so we can compare like-type injuries. Following a grade 2B stricture, stricture incidence has been reported to be as high as 71%. Grade 3 burn strictures as high as 100%. Now, attempts have been made to determine which patients should undergo EGD after corrosive ingestion, and just by the sound of that is implying that perhaps we can delineate who definitely mandates a endoscopy and who perhaps shouldn't. Now, some authors recommend that all patients have ingested undergo a esophageal gastroscopy, and particularly in light that studies have shown that patients who are asymptomatic will still have significant esophageal or gastric injury. Those papers that advocate basically mandatory endoscopy are Privatera and colleagues in Pediatric Emergency Care, 1990, Volume 6, pages 176 to 178. Katska in Current Treatment Opinions in Gastroenterology, year 2001, Volume 4, pages 59 to 66. And then Squires and colleagues in Journal of Pediatric Gastrointestinal Nutrition, 1996. So these are somewhat kind of going back there in time. But the argument made by these authors is that people could have and have been demonstrated to have rather significant esophageal tissue injury in the absence of any overt symptomatology. Now, Gupta and colleagues in Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition in 2001, volume 32, pages 50 to 53, took on a different perspective, and that was a retrospective study, and they found that asymptomatic patients who had unintentionally, the key word here is unintentionally, ingested a corrosive were unlikely to have clinically significant esophageal injury. Now, additionally, a retrospective review of children who had ingested, say, something hair relaxer, which often contains sodium or lithium hydroxide and may have a pH greater than 11, found that despite the presence of lip and oral pharyngeal injury, the patients who underwent EGD, none had greater than a grade 1 esophageal or gastric injury, and none had adverse clinical outcome. Now, these data suggest that the need for endoscopy should be made on clinical case-by-case basis. Typical indications which EGD should be strongly considered include visible posterior pharyngeal burns, stridor, vomiting, chest or abdominal pain, or the inability or outright refusal to drink. Perhaps most notably, patients who have ingested corrosives as a suicide attempt should undergo EGD because these patients often consume larger volumes and typically they're more corrosive agents as compared to those who have unintentionally ingested corrosives, namely children, and as such, they are at increased risk for esophageal or gastric injury in those who intentionally ingest caustic agents. So there are clear, you know, as we said at the outset, is that there's a different biology of some of these injuries. And it would indicate by looking at it from this perspective that a corrosive ingestion in a child is a much different problem than a corrosive ingestion in an adult. Pediatric corrosive ingestions are typically accidental. A lot of this stuff really tastes horrible. So once the child, you know, puts a small amount of it in their mouth, they're not going to continue to basically chug down the whole bottle of lye. Whereas an adult who has, you know, perhaps a major depressive episode is clearly suicidal, and I've seen this, do an entire bottle of Gatorade filled with acid. And so you would approach those two patients much differently. There's a lot of neat modalities now in endoscopy to evaluate the mucosal involvement, particularly neoplasms, endoscopic ultrasound being one of them. There have been some papers that have looked at the role of endoscopic ultrasound in the evaluation of caustic injuries. The problem is that there's not a whole lot of people who have a whole lot of exposure to patients with caustic injuries. It's a reasonably rare occurrence. Except it seems around at Vanderbilt lately. We've had about 3 in 2 months. But the other thing is getting this. These injuries typically occur at night. They occur on the weekend. It's quite frankly difficult. We've kind of abandoned getting anybody other than ourselves to endoscope these patients. Trying to get an endoscopic ultrasound just seems like a very difficult thing to get done at present time, maybe perhaps in the future. We scope our patients rather early, and we actually will pass an endoscopic feeding tube down at the same time. Now, treatment. Activated charcoal administration is commonly used after a variety of overdoses and ingestions, but really has no role in a caustic ingestion. It really complicates the endoscopy evaluation, so you can't really evaluate the mucosa to determine whether a patient needs surgical intervention, and charcoal does not absorb caustic agents. There seems to be some argument back and forth in the literature about the use of neutralizing agent, and there's some arguments that, particularly in animal studies, that the exothermic reactions does not really bear out in vitro studies. Nevertheless, there's no data to support the practice in humans, and it's currently not routinely recommended to try to neutralize, say, an acid with a base or a base with an acid. early on, I commented the solution for pollution is dilution, and clearly pH neutralization by dilution it has been suggested as a possible means for slowing down or decreasing esophageal injury after caustic ingestion. There has been a study that investigated dilution with milk and water after exposing rat esophagi to 50% sodium hydroxide. The investigators concluded that early dilution with milk or water decreased esophageal injury from alkali exposure. And that paper was by Homan and colleagues in Annals of Emergency Medicine, 1994, volume 24, pages 14 to 20. Though these studies were done in rats, there really is no human data to support this practice, and as such, it's currently not recommended routinely because of concerns over potential emesis, obscuring the endoscopy, as well as increasing luminal pressure, leading to potential perforation. Other treatments have been suggested immediately following corrosive ingestions. These include enteral or parenteral proton pump inhibitors, H2 blockers. These agents have been used to suppress the reflux of gastric contents back into the esophagus, therefore minimizing esophageal injury. There's one study that found increased gastric injury when H2 blockers were administered immediately following corrosive ingestion. In that particular study, the authors postulated that this increase in gastric injury was a result of stomach acid suppression and decreased caustic neutralization, which led them to recommend starting the treatment at 24 hours after caustic ingestion. And to date, however, there's really no clinical trials that demonstrate any efficacy in that practice at all. Perhaps the most commonly complication after caustic ingestions is the formation of strictures as well as esophageal malignant transformation. Strictures have been reported to develop about 26 to 55% of patients who ingest caustic substances. Really early interventions are aimed at preventing or minimizing the complication of strictures. The most common and perhaps the most controversial treatment used to prevent stricture formations are the use of parenteral corticosteroids and antibiotics. Corticosteroids are believed to attenuate some of the inflammation and granulous and fibrous tissue formation following a caustic injury. Reference for that is Jane and colleagues in Emergency Medicine Clinics, North America, 2003, volume 21, pages 1117 to 1144. I'm not a big fan of giving steroids or thinking it's a cure for everything that ails you. I think it's used for everything, including the heartbreak of psoriasis. There has been a prospective study that found no benefit from systemic steroid administration in children who had ingested caustic substances, and that development of strictures was related only to the severity of the esophageal injury. That references Anderson and colleagues, the New England Journal of Medicine, 1990, volume 323, pages 637 to 640. There was a meta-analysis by Pelklova and colleagues. It was in Toxicology Review in 2005. And what the authors found there was that was a meta-analysis of studies published between 1991 to 2004. And the they found that corticosteroids are of no benefit and do not significantly decrease the incidence of strictures after corrosive ingestion. And based on that meta-analysis, they recommended the abandonment of the practice of giving corticosteroids after esophageal injury. And I would tend to agree with that. Other investigators have supported that conclusion, finding systemic steroid treatment had no benefit effect on esophageal wound healing following caustic esophageal burns. There have been no prospective clinical trials evaluating the utility of antibiotics alone, and the value of antibiotics following caustic ingestion without signs of concomitant infection, such as peritonitis or mediastinitis, is unknown. Despite the 1,000-time greater incidence of esophageal cancer in patients who have ingested caustics over the general population, routine screening is not currently recommended. But I do think that number is kind of cool, that somebody who has a caustic injection has a 1,000-time greater incidence for development of esophageal CA. There are some emerging therapies looking at ways to reduce the incidence of stricture formation. There has been some theory that reactive oxygen species generated after the caustic ingestion may have a contributory role. And for that, there's been some animal studies, particularly with the use of vitamin E, which caused a decrease in collagen synthesis as well as stricture formation. There's also ketaphen, which is an H1 blocker and a mast cell stabilizer, when either given orally or intraperitoneally to rats, decrease stricture formation and fibrosis after caustic ingestion. So there is some interesting stuff coming up in rats, but currently data in humans is lacking, and these treatments really only are experimental at this point in time. Strictures are a real hassle in these patients, and certainly you want to try to prevent and treat them as they occur, including bougie dilatation, esophageal stent placement, intralesional corticosteroid injection, endoscopic dilatation after stricture formation have all been used. Instrumentation of the esophagus can lead to perforation, especially during days 7 to 21 after ingestion, and it's at this time the area of the burn is really the weakest, and most likely this is where the necrotic tissue begins to slough at this point in time. Despite this, early prophylactic dilatation with bougies has been shown to be safe and effective at reducing the time to stricture formation. Esophageal stents have also been shown to reduce the incidence of stricture formation as well. Once strictures have been formed, patients should require endoscopic balloon dilatation or bougie dilatation. Multiple dilatations may be required long-term for strictures to resolve. However, stable patients may be able to perform the dilatation at home, hence eliminating the need for frequent hospital admissions. Some authors advocate intralesional cortical steroid injections as a way of augmenting stricture dilation. They found that using intralesional steroid injection, while technically difficult, reduces the number of dilations required for stricture resolution. Now, surgical intervention may be necessary if these treatments fail or the presence of ligament transformation or lengthy or very tight strictures. Surgical options include colonic or small bowel interposition, gastric transposition. Although these procedures are often highly invasive, a minimally invasive technique has been described using thoracoscopic or laparoscopic techniques. The real meat and potatoes of these kind of injuries is what happens when you suspect the patient has mediastinitis or gastric perforation. It's time for the operating room, and it's time for a rather large procedure. And when we do this and we find that we've got gastric necrosis or esophageal necrosis, and we're dealing with stage 3B esophageal lesions, the real question is, you know, what do we do with that? And esophageal resection, gastrectomy are often necessary in order to debride the dead tissue, treat the perforation, and hopefully try to preserve the life of the patient. That concludes the topic of esophageal caustic injuries or caustic ingestions. My name is Jeffrey Guy. I'm an associate professor of surgery at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, where I'm the director of the Burn Center there. If you enjoyed the podcast, find these useful, by all means, we'd appreciate you going to the iTunes site and leaving some favorable feedback. We also have started kind of a Facebook group site for people to kind of exchange ideas, dialogues, post questions, and a lot of times the other listeners to the podcast have answered them, and I think we actually learn more from each other than from, you know, a single person teaching. So by all means, check that out as well. There's a other podcast, which is Pharmacology for the Pre-Hospital Professional. Many people listening are paramedics or pre-hospital providers. Even if you're not, I think there's reasonably good podcasts over there regarding topics of pharmacology, different vasopressors. Last week we did a podcast on this site on IV fluids, which was a post from the pharmacology website. And this week we'll finish up that discussion on part 2 on IV fluids. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.